This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Some of the biggest changes in Australia's industrial relations laws in years are on the brink of becoming reality. The Albanese government's Workplace Relations Bill has passed the Senate and will get final approval from the lower house this morning. While unions are welcoming the changes, many businesses remain wary, as John Daly explains.
For dairy farmer Ross Woodhouse, it's a bit of a struggle to keep his dairy farms on WA's south coast turning a profit.
Well, as tough as it's ever been, John. I know not say whinging farmers, but we've had quantum leap all our input costs and very, very marginal increases in our pricing when it comes to milk.
On top of that, it's hard to find staff, even though he's lifted wages.
We've had pay probably 30% more in the last 12 months just because of the competitive market. It's at crisis point, I guess, because we just can't. We haven't had the increases that we need to just pay the day-to-day bills and then to have wages on top of it.
With 30 full-time workers, Ross Woodhouse's business could be drawn into the federal government's new multi-employer bargaining system. And he fears that might mean he'll be pulled into a wage deal that will ignore his specific operating conditions.
Oh, look, I think it takes away our power to negotiate from the position that we're in. You know, we're quite genuine. It's not all about keeping profits for the owners. It's about making the ends meet. We've still got a business.
Businesses with fewer than 20 employees will be excluded from the single interest multi-employer bargaining, while those with up to 50, like Ross Woodhouse, will have more safeguards to be able to opt out. Craig Hegarton is the chair of the farmer-owned cooperative WAMCO, a WA meat processor employing 350 workers. WAMCO just brokered a four-year enterprise agreement, though Mr. Hegarton is nervous about the bargaining system it'll be subject to when that ends.
It's going to be a very interesting, the first few test cases that go through to this to see how it works. But in our situation, we'd rather be dealing with our own employees rather than acting on behalf of employees of another company as well. It's a really strange scenario.
Carolyn Smith is the aged care director and WA secretary for the United Workers Union, which represents 150,000 workers across 45 industries. She says Australia is facing a wage crisis and workers will benefit from these reforms.
Some of those care sector industries, a whole lot of those contracting industries, and some of those industries we see like food processing. So I think it's really going to have an impact, in many, many industries. But the major impact I think we will see is some of those feminised industries. If we want to have someone to look after our children while we go to work, if we want to have someone to look after our parents and grandparents, we have to make sure that those workers have a way to get a living wage.
The government has more industrial relations changes in its sights for next year, including cracking down on the use of labour hire and regulating the gig economy.
John Daly reporting there. Senior US military officers are describing Australia as a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow as they eye off this continent's prime geography for future space operations. With growing strategic competition against China, the US Space Force believes this country is a vital strategic asset for the emerging warfare domain. Defence correspondent Andrew Green prepared this report.
Today, space is essential not only to our way of life, it's absolutely critical to the modern way of war.
The United States Space Force will soon celebrate its third birthday, and some of its highest-ranking officers are currently in Australia looking to expand defence cooperation with an old military ally.
We're talking about future partnerships that we can have.
Lieutenant General Nina Amano is the Director of Staff of the US Space Force and is meeting senior figures from the Australian Defence Force and local industry.
This is prime country for space domain awareness.
General Amano has travelled to Canberra along with Lieutenant General John Shaw, the Deputy Commander of the US Space Command, responsible for America's combat capabilities above Earth. The three-star officer warns a conflict in space is a very real prospect.
It may begin with what we call reversible effects of jamming of satellite communications and such, or of dazzling with directed energy of intelligence surveillance reconnaissance platforms. Could be cyber attacks against our space systems and architecture, so not just the satellites, but the links, the ground nodes, and the user architecture. Ultimately, it could go to some sort of kinetic activity.
Both of the visiting military officers believe the war in Ukraine is demonstrating the growing importance of space as a new warfighting domain. Last year, Russia conducted a direct descent anti-satellite test to destroy one of its own aging assets. And General Shaw says another potential adversary, China, is making rapid progress in the field.
It certainly very swiftly advanced their space technology capabilities. And I won't get the numbers exactly right, but they had very few satellites 20 years ago, and now they have hundreds. They've advanced very, very quickly.
Australia's own Defence Space Command was only formally stood up in March, but General Amano says this country already has the natural advantage of its southern hemisphere geography and its potential launch sites close to the equator.
It seems as Australia is sitting on a pot of gold, at the end of the rainbow, for our common national security interests.
It's just another example of how Australia continues to be a critical asset for the US, particularly when it comes to strategic competition with China.
Andrew Green reporting. A federal parliamentary inquiry will examine the enduring impact of repeated head trauma in sport. Some of Australia's biggest sporting stars and coaches might be called to give evidence about their experiences of concussion, as Rachel Mealy reports.
Rugby union player Jade Hubbard has seen firsthand how differently concussion is treated in her sport.
I've seen women get concussed. The way that they got treated was completely different to how I was treated playing for Queensland.
She recalls how a player in her club rugby side was concussed during a game.
The young girl that had her concussion, she was back playing the week after, so I don't think she was actually given the right sort of treatment. What happened on the field to her, like she said, she blacked out. She had lost sensation in her toes or something, or like pins and needles or something in her feet.
But when Jade Hubbard experienced a concussion while playing on a representative team, she found the protocols were more stringent.
When I had my head knock, it was 12 days minimum I had to be out. I had a follow-up with the physio that was on our team physio every day doing tests.
Now, a federal parliamentary inquiry is examining concussions and repeated head trauma in contact sports at all levels. It was initiated by Greens Senator Lydia Thorpe, who's concerned elite and amateur sports people aren't getting the most up-to-date information about the risks and treatments, and it's won support from the major parties. Concussion researcher Professor Alan Pearce says for too long, Australian sporting codes have written their own rules.
We haven't really appreciated that concussion and repeated brain trauma in sport is more than just a professional issue, a professional sport issue. It's a community-wide issue, and we really need to get an understanding of how wide and how deep do we need to investigate what's happening with regards to protecting our players at all levels of the game.
Repeated head trauma and concussion is a known cause of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which leads to a degeneration of the brain and can only be diagnosed after death. Professor Pearce says the link's been made in clinical research, and yet many sporting guidelines on concussion don't reflect that.
We're not really recognising, or at the top level with the consensus group are still not necessarily recognising the science that has gone into demonstrating the links between repetitive head trauma and the risk of CTE and other brain diseases like Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disease, and Alzheimer's and dementia. So we really need to get to, into understanding how we can actually get this through to everyone.
Peter Jess is an AFL players agent who's been pushing for a more uniform approach across sporting codes.
This inquiry will give us a reset button where we can actually look at this with a clean pair of eyes and not impeded by the biases of all of the sports bodies. This is a clean view of what needs to happen.
He believes peak bodies in the field of concussion in sport and sporting bodies themselves have relied on flawed research.
What we found is that the narrative has always talked about that it is transitory. What we know from the clinical studies that we have done is that this is far from transitory. Once you damage the brain, it is permanent.
The parliamentary inquiry will report by the middle of next year.
Rachel Mealy reporting there. Things are going from bad to worse for Prince William and his wife on a visit to the United States. As they were flying into Boston, they had to issue a statement on a racism row engulfing Buckingham Palace. And now they're dealing with the release of a preview of a tell-all documentary starring Prince Harry and his wife Meghan. North America correspondent Barbara Miller compiled this report.
On the surface, the royal visit to Boston is going well.
Oh, my God, I'm just blown away. They were so lovely.
Adoring fans line the streets, including little Henry, who dressed up as a King's Guard and got to meet the Prince and Princess of Wales.
I asked them where Prince George was, and they answered and said that he was in school. I'm going to scream to my BFF Baxter and tell them I'm famous.
The heir to the throne and his wife are in Boston for 3 days to present the awards in their Earthshot Prize for contributions to environmentalism. But the other royal couple over in California are making headlines too. A trailer for their highly anticipated Netflix documentary has just dropped.
When the stakes are this high, doesn't it make more sense to hear our story from us?
Netflix says Harry and Meghan is an unprecedented 6-part documentary series that explores the span of the couple's relationship. But it's the parts that focus on the relationship between Prince Harry and the Duchess of Sussex and the rest of the royals that are creating the most waves.
I had to do everything I could to protect my family.
The 59-second clip includes images of Meghan crying while bent over making a phone call and weeping again while sitting on a sofa with an exasperated Harry throwing back his head.
No one sees what's happening behind closed doors.
In Boston, while Prince William and Catherine politely chatted with workers at a climate innovation hub, there was no mention of the trailer, nor of the racism row that overshadowed their arrival in the States. The British woman at the centre of that row, charity worker Ngozi Fulani, has spoken to the BBC about what she said was a traumatic encounter at a Buckingham Palace reception, believed to involve Prince William's godmother and longtime lady-in-waiting to the late Queen, Susan Hussey.
It's a horrible experience, right? No matter how uncomfortable it is for other people to accept, I'm very clear that I experienced racism in an environment that I should have felt safe in, and we need to address that.
Ms. Fulani said the encounter involved the other woman touching her hair and quizzing her about her ethnic origins.
She said, "What's your nationality?" And I said, "Lady, I was born here, I'm British." I was thinking that would be the end of it. No. No, where are you really from? Where are your people from? Lady, my people. What is this, you know?
Tomorrow, the Prince and Princess of Wales are due to meet President Biden before the awards ceremony for the Earthshot Prize, for which a group of Indigenous female rangers from Queensland have been shortlisted. It's the royal couple's first visit to the US in 8 years, one which looks set to be memorable for all the wrong reasons. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
For many people with disability, just getting around their local suburb or town can be a challenge at times. But the West Australian city of Bunbury is trying to change that, aiming to become the best example of an accessible city in Australia. Ahead of tomorrow's International Day of People with Disability, Anthony Pansia prepared this report.
Dolphins over there.
Whoa. Oh, where?
There.
The dolphins have come out to play off the coast of Kumbana Bay in Bunbury, Western Australia.
Oh, my God, yeah.
As excited onlookers make their way to the water's edge on this beach 2 hours south of Perth, Mark Blowers wheels his way to a viewing platform. Mark Blowers was diagnosed with functional neurological disorder and is paralysed from the waist down.
Any dolphins out today?
But recent improvements to the Kumbana Bay foreshore no longer limit his trip to the beach to just the viewing platform.
Normally I'd be restricted to the balcony lookout tower here, which is probably about 20 metres from the water. Now we have the beach mat that goes down onto the sand. We can get down there. But also we have the tracks which will go right to the water's edge.
The additions are part of a strategy by the City of Bunbury to claim the title of most accessible community in Western Australia. And it's also aiming for the even loftier goal of being the most accessible regional city in Australia. It's yet to be recognised with either of those titles, but advocates say it's not for a lack of trying. Edith Cowan University's sessional academic, Adam Johnson, was part of the City of Bunbury's Access Committee in 2014.
We were asking ourselves, how well are we doing? We've got really no measures as to how well we're doing compared to, you know, apples for apples, you know, compared to Albany, Geelong, you know, like other regional cities around Australia.
And the councils found local business owners are keen to get on board.
Representatives from the city worked with some of the cafes in Bunbury. You know, they're both fantastically accessible now. That cost them a lot of money to make that accessible by putting in those ramps. They lost some floor space in the shop. But no one would go back now and say, nah, you know, I want to put that back. I want to put steps there and regain that floor space. That took a deliberate decision on their part to make it accessible.
University of Western Australia's head of social sciences, Professor Amanda Davies, says the measures will have multiple positive outcomes.
As a community like Bunbury really seeks to have a very integrated and forward-moving plan for accessibility, it absolutely can then become a reason why people move into the area, but more importantly, why people stay. If you increase accessibility, you can also increase the capacity for people to be very meaningfully engaged in the labour force and into sort of social activities.
Back at Kumbana Bay, Mark Blowers is willing his hometown toward the title of most accessible community in Western Australia.
For everybody that's worked on the project, that would be really satisfying. And of course, it is ultimately the benefit of the people who need it.
Bunbury resident Mark Blowers ending that report from Anthony Pansia. Former Paralympian Kurt Fernley has taken on arguably one of his toughest roles. It's almost been 2 months since he was appointed the chairman of the National Disability Insurance Agency Board, the body that administers the NDIS. Many in the disability community wanted one of their own to represent them at that level, so the job comes with a weight of expectations. Kurt Fernley speaking here with our National Disability Affairs reporter, Elizabeth Wright.
Seven weeks.
Kurt Fernley is the first to say that he's fresh in the job, and the disability sector has wasted no time in letting him know what they want.
You don't know how many thousands of people have stopped me on the streets and said that they want to see this NDIS as successful. We're at a period of time where community are well and truly behind the success of the NDIS.
He's the first person with lived experience to be appointed chair of the board of the National Disability Insurance Agency.
We are seeing people with disabilities take up roles like my own. But there are still gains that need to be made. We need to make sure that we get into the parts of the world where we are yet to be invited into.
Challenges aren't new to Kurt Fernley. He's a gold medal winning Paralympian and Commonwealth Games athlete, a broadcaster, author and corporate speaker. But he's faced questions about his suitability for the new job.
Somebody said the other day that my role was nothing but symbolism. And well, firstly, I think that symbolism can be extraordinarily powerful. Secondly, when you are the first person that is invited into a room, you recognise the responsibility in that. And it's up to me to ensure that this role, being the first person with a disability to be able to play a part in it, it is not seen as symbolism because we make the gains that the community believe in.
An independent review of the NDIS is underway. In the meantime, tomorrow marks 30 years since International Day of People with Disability first began, and Kurt Fernley says it remains an important event.
The reality of disability worldwide is incredibly challenging. I think that when you do travel around the world and you see the reality, especially in the developing world, it can be really tough. So I think a day is about taking gains wherever we are able to in the disability community. And I'm sure that there will be a day where we don't need this, I'm sure. But it's not today. It's definitely not today.
That's Kurt Fernley, Chair of the National Disability Insurance Agency, speaking with Elizabeth Wright. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
integrity in politics has been in the spotlight, the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison being censured by the Parliament over his secret ministries, in the same week a National Anti-Corruption Commission has passed. Today, Radio Breakfast host Patricia Karvelas on how the new body could go some way to restore confidence in our political system. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.